Horses on 2FM.
Yes, well, a big thank you to Conor Bean for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 27th of June, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, we'll hear from our men's rugby sevens team. As Dave, just one game away now from the Paris Olympics.
And that will be against Great Britain tonight. And in hurling, Niall Moran is going to focus on the final four as Tipperary and Dublin exit the championship. While in cricket, we'll ask where Ireland got it wrong as our World Cup dream falls apart.
We'll also get the latest from Mark Langdon as Bayern Munich set their sights on Harry Kane. And Chidozie Ogbeni is going to be playing Premier League football next year. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
I was watching European games earlier. I was shouting for Spain, Shane.
You were shouting for Spain?
I thought it was definitely going to be easier for Ireland to beat Spain than it might be to beat Great Britain.
Ah, listen, you know, to be the best, you have to beat the best. Isn't that what they say? Now, there
You're not in, you can't win. And I'd be always looking for the easiest way into something.
I'd always, any team I've supported or played at lower levels, I would always want to play against, test yourself against the big team. So yeah, 8:35 PM Irish time. Is Ireland versus Great Britain not
and there
Spain.
Was a link on the RTU website earlier, it was in one of the stories to that game if you did want to watch it in silence, there is no commentary, but there was a link to a streaming of the game. It was on the RTE Sports website earlier.
Oh, okay. I think there was our colleague Will Downing, who does a bit of Olympic commentary and whatnot, I think was saying that there was meant to be world feed commentary on all the events basically, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So
no, it was fairly easy. Pick out the team in green, all the same.
Yeah. This is true. Well, as Ruby mentioned, the men's rugby sevens team have beaten Portugal 24-0 today to advance to this evening's final against Great Britain, where the winner will secure Olympic qualification. We can hear from two players that were involved in that match, Harry McNulty and Billy Dardis, who sounded a bit tired after today's win.
Oh, semi-finals are pretty difficult games. You know, there's a lot of nerves going into them, there's a lot of prep. Anything can happen, like rugby Europe especially. You just see teams getting beaten left, right and centre, and we just knew we had to bring our best. And the one thing I asked the lads before running out was to bring themselves, and that's all we could ask for. And all of us collected means that we're a team and we can do our best. So, look, fantastic result against a strong Portuguese side that we've played loads. We're into the final. We're delighted with that. It means that we have secured a spot for the repechage, but we haven't come here for that. We've got one more game on our plate that we need to finish.
And I mean, it looks so inspired out there. Like, you're leaving nothing. It's like no mercy out there.
No, we threw everything at them, in fairness. There were some kick-throughs. We chased back incredibly well. We held on to the ball for long periods of time. Lots of defensive efforts as well. You can probably hear it in my voice. I'm pretty tired, but that's the game of sevens, and that's why we love it. And it's great to have a score reflect like the way that you played as well.
Yeah, I suppose just trying to regather and get your breath back after such a hectic game. It'll be a big few hours or a big night tonight with hopefully a big game. We have to try and recover now, focus and get on task for this big one. There's no motivation needed for a big Olympic qualifier, so just be about getting our jobs right, getting our roles right and going out there and executing.
Well, hopefully the lads will recuperate before 25-9 this evening, that match against Great Britain. Elsewhere in the European Games, modern pentathlete Sive Brasil has just come up short in her quest to make the final, finishing her semi-final in 15th place. Derry triathlete Erin McConnell put in a strong performance to place 27th in the women's individual triathlon this morning in very, very challenging conditions. Just Google Erin McConnell or European Games triathlon. It was ridiculous weather in Poland for that one. In fencing, Ireland's only competitor in the men's pay, Giacomo Patrick Pietro Belli, exited the competition by the narrowest of margins in table of 64, losing 15-14 to Jonathan Svensson of Sweden. In archery, Ireland's Emma Davis has exited the European Games after losing to Austrian Elizabeth Stratke 6-0 in the women's individual recurve. All six badminton players are in action throughout the day. In the second of their group games, mixed doubles pairing of Joshua McGee and Moya Ryan have got off to a winning start, defeating Slovakia's Durat and Vargova 2-0. Rachel Dara beat her Serbian opponent a short time ago. In boxing this evening, flyweight Dana Murhaus, featherweight Michaela Walsh and middleweight Aoife O'Rourke all contest their last 16 bouts, hoping to continue a good run of form for the Irish boxers after a near perfect day yesterday. And it's gotten off to a good start in the last few moments because Dana Murhaus has defeated her Ukrainian opponent Tatiana Kolb 3-2. So, victory for Murhaus. Hopefully there will be victory for Michaela Walsh. We'll keep you updated with that throughout the show. And Aoife O'Rourke is in the ring at 7:15, just as we come off air. So, good day, Ruby. But a very good day for the boxers yesterday. And
more pluses than minuses, Shane.
Exactly.
That's the way I look exactly. At it. But at least we're not English cricket.
This is true. And that leads us to introduce Nathan Johns, Irish Times cricket journalist, into the conversation there, Nathan, because you might be able to shed some more light on Ruby's comment there of at least we're not English cricket, because Ruby says that in light of the widespread and deep-rooted racism, sexism, elitism and class-based discrimination at all levels of the game and urgent reforms that are needed, that were they announced in a landmark report today, the 317-page report from the Independent Commission for Equity in Cricket, the ICEC, which drew on evidence from more than 4,000 players, coaches, administrators and fans, also urges the sport to also face up to the fact that it's not banter or just a few bad apples causing the problems. The England and Wales Cricket Board responded to the report by issuing an unreserved apology for its failure to adequately tackle discrimination and said the findings were a seminal moment for the sport. It's pledged to respond to 44 recommendations made by the ICEC within 3 months. So, Nathan Johns of the Irish Times, what does this mean for the game in England?
It's incredibly difficult to say. I mean, it's a very difficult day, obviously. It's yet another of these findings in cricket in the last 12 to 18 months that is very damning. We saw the Azam Rafiq stuff up in Yorkshire and his allegations. We saw Cricket Scotland, their board has been completely overhauled because of racism allegations. And now we've seen, yes, another report. I suppose this one is interesting because it's probably the most wide-reaching one in that it's not just racism, it's sexism and classism as well, all put into one report. In many ways, it's surprising and shocking, and in many ways, it's not. I think it's really important at the outset of a conversation like this to say that the individual detail and individual allegations that are detailed in, I think it was over 4,000 people responded to the report. Every single one of those is shocking and terrible, and I won't necessarily go into those because some of them are quite upsetting. But equally, based on the climate and the context of what's gone on in English cricket and world cricket, I know we said we're not English cricket, but you know, we just haven't had the reports yet.
Yeah,
I have no reason to believe that anything like that is coming down the line yet in Irish cricket. But everyone has a certain image of cricket globally. In England, you know, is the colonial white all boys club, and there's been lots of evidence that supported that over recent years. They're taking steps to try and get past that. But this is yet another damning piece of evidence that says, according to many people, that is exactly what cricket is at the minute.
When you look at this, how popular cricket is globally in countries with huge populations, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, West Indies, it encompasses so many people of different races and different ethnic backgrounds. Has English cricket fallen behind in the world by being the way it is?
I wouldn't say it's fallen behind, because this position has always been there, and I think every country has its racial problems. It's the nature of cricket, like you said, that it brings together lots of people from lots of different backgrounds, and I think the nature of cricket as a very colonial sport, I mean, all those countries you're mentioning there are former British colonies, so there's a tension there at the way the sport was brought to these countries is very adversarial and based around conflict and colonization. And it was kind of, you know, educating the masses. We teach them our ways. We teach them cricket. So there's always been that kind of double standard. And it just so happened that a lot of these countries got very good at cricket. And you know, over the last 100 years, there's been a process of integrating those countries into English systems and all over the world. But these problems exist everywhere you go. It's just because England is kind of the standard bearer, so to speak, as the power that it made cricket, the power that brought the world cricket, it's quite often the first one to see these effects, primarily because of its history. It's got such a diverse multicultural background because of its colonial past. So there's a lot of things going on here, but I wouldn't say it's fallen behind. I would just say this has always been the case, and we're only coming to terms with it in the last 20 years.
Is this systemic throughout all of English cricket, or is there a bit of a disconnect here? Because you see that, say, for example, I know we were chatting off air that when England celebrate, they don't have champagne and bottles of beer because of Muslim players who are involved, Australia likewise as well. Yet, but then when you break it down to not only racism but elitism as well, that I think one of the quotes were that it's elitist, exclusionary, private school and old boys network. Like, I mean, you have like school games of Eton and
Harrow,
like and all of this as well. You've people within English cricket that I feel almost want to be elitist. We see that with the MCC silk tie and this all boys club and everything else. Like, is it across the board that this is a major issue?
Well, no. Then the MCC point is really interesting, because so I was in Lourdes a few weeks ago for the Ireland game, and you walk down St John's Wood, the road that leads up to Lourdes, on a test match day, and it's right, it doesn't matter if it's 30 degrees out, it's primarily men, it's primarily white men wearing suits and ties that are, you know, dressed up for the occasion. Whereas if you go to Lourdes in August, when that new competition, the 100, is on, it's in its third iteration, it's kind of the new competition they brought in to try and sell cricket a little bit more, that's a much younger, a much more diverse in terms of gender, age and racial crowd. And the English cricket has kind of said, right, well, we need to get away from the, I hate saying the Lord's image, but it's one of many grounds that has that image, but Lord's is the first one that everyone thinks of. We need to get away from that, and this is the third iteration of a competition now where that happens. So it's not every aspect of cricket, and I haven't got the data to hand, but there is a lot of data that has been put out there that says, yeah, we do have initiatives to attract new audiences to the game, and we have got younger, less white and less male-dominated crowds coming to different forms of cricket, but this is just a sign. I guess this is more so, this report was more to do with the grassroots, which is the really worrying thing, because you mentioned the senior sides have taken steps to be more inclusive. I mean, it's not that far ago that there were bottles of champagne being sprayed around, and if you had two or three Muslim lads on the team, they just stayed off to the side and joined you once the champagne
had been
sprayed.
I think Sky did have a few pictures of, I was watching the Ashes, and it was like one of the Ashes a while ago when they were celebrating, they're all champagne, and even I think it was Nasser or Batters or someone made the kind of comment of like, and there's Moeen Ali and whoever was sipping his Coca-Cola for obvious reasons, and you're like, can we all just come together on that?
So that's a very recent development, but it is an interesting one, isn't it?
It's
the top of the game is making these, and we mean top of the game in terms of being more inclusive to players who are playing, and equally different leagues to attract different crowds. They're putting forward these steps and putting forward this imagery of being more inclusive, but I wouldn't say there's a disconnect between that and the grassroots game, which is what this report deals with, but maybe it's just taking a while for that to filter down.
It's going to take a lot of change, I would think. I think there will be uproar over the Oxford v Cambridge match being scrapped and the Eton v Harrow game going.
Well, there was.
They were going for a while.
They tried to scrap Oxford Cambridge. There's a massive campaign a year, 18 months ago, maybe even 2 years ago, from about getting the women playing at Lourdes as well, the Oxford-Cambridge game. So there's two grounds at Lourdes. There's the main ground and the nursery ground, and the nursery is the training facility. And the women would play at the same time as the men in that university match on the nursery ground. So there's a big campaign from female players, some of those universities, to get on the main ground. And that meant that they had to shorten the men's game and play the women's game and the men's game on the same day. And, you know, by and large, the students themselves were all for this, but there's loads of people in MCC members who would have been in uproar. And I think last year, if I'm not, it was either last year or the year before, it was supposed to be the last time that game was played at Lourdes. But they've managed to, there was so much uproar at the MCC that it's back.
It's bizarre. And of course, the England women's team are yet to play a test at Lourdes as well, the home of cricket. So, an interesting report, and certainly one that hopefully will gather legs, and hopefully there are actual changes and not just mealy-mouthed apologies. Nathan Johns, you're going to be sticking around because we're going to be chatting Irish cricket in the wake of a failed World Cup qualification bid, and the Irish women's team are in action against the West Indies yesterday, so we'll get your thoughts on that in due course. But Mark Langdon is on the line to chat football and football transfers. And Mark, we were all brief and we're going to be chatting about plenty of Premier League transfers and everything else. What I wasn't expecting was my first question to be an Irishman in the Premier League. Your thoughts on Chidozie Ogbeni? It is a bit left of field. I didn't even hear any of rumours that he was going to be joining Luton Town.
No, Luton have obviously managed to keep this one fairly quiet. And he's out of contract at Rotherham. You know, he's done very well for Rotherham. This is obviously a great move for the player. You know, Luton, I think Luton need to be, I would say, clever in their transfers. I mean, they can't go and compete with the top half of the Premier League. They need to try to buy the best Championship players. They won't be saying this outwardly, but inwardly, they probably already thinking, if we go down, let's make sure we've got a strong championship team for next season. They're not going to be able to attract sort of players from the top half of the Premier League because their wage bill just will not stretch that far. So that they do have to be clever with their signings. But they've shown before that, you know, when they've been getting promoted throughout the divisions all the way up to the Premier League, they've always had an eye for a good transfer, that they use data analytics and sort of a lot of the same kind of stats that Brentford and Brighton have used previously to good effect. So Ogbeni probably comes out well on those. I would trust them to make good signings, Luton. And Rob Edwards was also saying that one of the main sort of reasons for signing him was because of his attitude and the fact that he's going to be a good signing in the dressing room. And I think that's important. A team like Luton cannot be carrying egos and the kind of players that think that they're too big and too good for Luton. So I think it's a sensible signing, and you can expect more of that type, I would have thought, from Luton as they bid to stay in the Premier League. Looks a tough ask for them, but you never know. I mean, that they just keep on improving, season on season. Even when they lose Nathan Jones, they just seem to get better and better.
Well, I can imagine Stephen Kenny would have a few more recommendations for Luton Town if they so wanted them. But moving on from Ogbeni, Harry Kane, he's open to a move to Bayern Munich. Can you see him going to Germany?
I couldn't have seen it until sort of today, really, when the news came out that Kane would be open to the move to the Allianz and to join Bayern Munich. I just felt that, you know, he maybe would consider the Premier League the place to be unless Real Madrid came in for him. He obviously, I think, would like to leave Tottenham, and maybe there just aren't that many options available to him, and there would still be time after he went to Bayern to come back and break Alan Shearer's Premier League goal scoring record. The problem is that Harry Kane can want to leave. Bayern Munich can want Harry Kane, as Manchester City found out. Getting him out of Tottenham while he's under contract is not easy, and the opening bid of 70 million I think would be some way short of what Tottenham would be looking for, even though he's only got 1 year left of his contract. I mean, you know, the finances involved in Tottenham finishing in the top four and qualifying for the Champions League, you know, potentially could even finish fifth and be in the Champions League because of the way the competition is changing for the year 24-25, with potentially a fifth team from England joining. That is worth a lot of money to Tottenham. So I think Bayern are going to have to significantly up their opening offer to get close to signing Harry Kane. If they got to 85-90, then that might be something where Tottenham feel like it's better to sell him and try to reinvest that money. But around 70 million, just don't see it with Daniel Levy.
Just before we move away from the Harry Kane topic, does the fact that if he does go, he'll have left without winning a trophy tarnish his legacy in any way?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it should anyway. He was part of a team that reached the Champions League final. They finished second in the Premier League, League Cup final, FA Cup semi-finals. They were knocking on the door. I wouldn't have thought so. Certainly not at Tottenham anyway. He broke the club's goal-scoring record, one that I don't think anybody ever believed would be broken. When he's caught Jimmy Greaves easily, and Jimmy Greaves is an absolute legend of English football and also at Tottenham. So I don't see why it should tarnish his career. He's won Premier League Golden Boots. He's won World Cup Golden Boots. But you can see why he would want, you know, to add team trophies to that. And if he went to Bayern, he'd have a very good chance of winning at least one trophy there, I would have thought.
Well, Spurs might be sitting on the fence about selling Harry Kane, but they're trying to buy James Maddison from Leicester City. Newcastle are interested too. Where do you think he'll end up?
I think it probably will be Tottenham. I mean, Spurs have already started their business. Vicario, the goalkeeper, has signed from Empoli in the last sort of 30 minutes or so. And I think Madison's the next one on the list. There was a tug of war with Newcastle at the start of the summer, but Newcastle looked to be heading towards signing the Italian international Tonali. And with their financial fair play issues, I think it'd be difficult to sign Tonali and Madison in the same transfer window. Tottenham have been desperately sort of in need of a creative midfielder ever since really Christian Eriksen departed the club. So I think Madison would be well suited to Spurs. Spurs have got a very good relationship with the agency that Maddison is connected to. They've signed a few players already from that sort of agency in the last couple of years. So I would have, I would imagine, unless something goes wrong, I would imagine that he would be heading towards Tottenham. But from Maddison's point of view, you know, you'd love to be in that number 10 position supplying Harry Kane rather than, you know, somebody else. So he might be slightly nervous if he thinks that Harry Kane's departing.
If he does go to Spurs, he will be coached by Ryan Mason, who has been named as Ange Postecoglou's assistant next season at Tottenham as well. Mike Jednak also arrives, and Chris Davis, who was on the coaching ticket at Liverpool, Celtic and Leicester City, is part of the coaching team as well. Mark Langdon, talk to me about Declan Rice. And I won't ask where you think he'll go. I want to get your thoughts on this narrative that is doing the rounds, that perhaps Mikel Arteta is just ringing up his old buddy Pep and saying, listen, stick in a bid there just so we can try and up our bid, and I can go to my owners and say, no, we have to up our bid to actually meet the asking price, and so on and so forth, that City don't really want Declan Rice. Are you buying that?
I'm not buying that, no. I mean, I don't think that Pep Guardiola and Mikel Arteta can be as close as they were and to get involved in that kind of shenanigans really now. I think that Arsenal are more interested than Manchester City in Declan Rice, and maybe that will persuade Declan Rice where his future lies, you know, because Arsenal have been absolutely, you know, like I say, they've been desperate to sign Declan Rice all summer. It feels like maybe an afterthought from City. You know, Gundogan's departed, they've signed Kovacic as one replacement, but you know, it almost feels like, well, he's available and maybe we could sign him. Whereas for Arsenal, you could see kind of Declan Rice potentially developing into a future captain at the Emirates. And maybe, you know, people are saying, oh, you know, why would you choose Arsenal over Manchester City? If he does decide to go to Arsenal, I would have thought it would have been that type of thing. Maybe the belief he can become a captain, or the fact that Arsenal have been so desperate to sign him. But I don't believe the collusion argument. And I don't know. It feels a little bit too far-fetched to me that Pep and Mikel Arteta would manage to come up with this just so that Arsenal pay the asking price for Declan Rice.
Well, West Ham are going to get well paid anyway, and the other people look to be taking money in. I know they spend plenty, but they look to be wanting it back are Chelsea. Kai Havertz might go to Arsenal. Ruben Loftus-Cheek, he's also on the move as well as all the players that have gone to the Middle East. Chelsea are cleaning out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a much needed clean out. You know, they obviously sold a lot of players to Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned there, Ruben. Havertz, and I just said there, Kovacic on his way to Manchester City. I think that the interesting thing from Chelsea was that they had way too many players last season. There were rumours that players were having to get changed sort of in a separate dressing room. They had that many around the training ground, and they were unable to put on competitive sessions because they just had too many players, too many first team players hanging around. And you know, a manager can only work with so many. You know, there are only so many routines that you can do that sort of suit. Usually you might have, you know, 11 starters and maybe 11 players sort of shadowing them, and you kind of do work on that. But I mean, Chelsea had in excess, I think, of 30 first team players, so they needed to get rid of players, and they also needed to get rid of players that other teams wanted. And that I think is where the balance has had to be struck really with Chelsea. Like they probably wouldn't have been desperate to have sold Kovacic to Manchester City, or maybe, you know, Mason Mount potentially off to Manchester United. But those are the players that have attracted interest, and so you have to, you know, you have to sell those. You might not be able to sell, say, a Raheem Sterling. I've no idea if Pochettino wants Sterling, but if nobody wants Sterling, you can't sell him anyway. I think Ruben Loftus-Cheek, you know, needs to move on. He's somebody that's just been hanging around Chelsea. Too much of a bit part player, had a lot of injuries. I think when he gets a run of games going, he's been a good, solid Premier League player. But at his age now, he needs to be playing every week. And he looks like being the replacement, actually, for Tonali, who I mentioned earlier on, going to Newcastle. But I'm really interested to see how Kovacic does at Manchester City. I felt he was underused by Chelsea. Whenever he played, he always seemed to make a difference. And I just wonder if kind of Pep Guardiola can get something else out of him. I'm sort of the opinion that maybe Chelsea might regret that one.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And news today that UEFA is also set to close a loophole tomorrow, allowing clubs to spread the cost of big transfer fees over lengthy contracts as well, which Chelsea have availed of. Mark, I might just go off script here. I know we were talking about players, but management, Roy Hodgson staying on at Crystal Palace. Are you surprised he's extended his stay?
I am. I was surprised when he came back. I'm even more surprised that he's staying on for another year. Look, he did well with Crystal Palace at the end of last season. Made sure there was no chance of them being dragged into that relegation battle. But it doesn't feel very progressive. And I think if I was a Crystal Palace fan, I'd just be wondering like kind of who's making the decisions there. It feels like a very defensive one in that they're not quite sure what they're looking for in a new manager, not quite sure sort of what club they want to be. And they just know or feel with Hodgson that he's like the safest pair of hands to make sure they're not relegated at the end of the season. Maybe I'm doing Hodgson a disservice, but I just feel if you're a Premier League team and an established one at that, Palace have been around, you know, the sort of mid-table now for a number of years. You feel like, I don't know, maybe they, you know, Graham Potter or somebody like that would have been a better choice for them to improve the football. They've got some talented players there, likes of Eze and Elise, potentially. You know, they might be able to get Zaha to re-sign as well. But the Palace fans do seem to like Roy Hodgson, but just looking at it from the outside, I don't know, it feels a little bit of a drab appointment to me.
OK, well, speaking of Crystal Palace, Wilfred Zaha leads a three-man consortium that includes Stormzy taking charge at AFC Croydon as well. Unfortunately, we've run out of time to get your thoughts on Stormzy, both Mark Lang and Ruby Walsh.
Thank you.
wanted that, I'd say, didn't you?
We'll leave that for our next conversation. You'll have a bit of time to digest and give me your favourite Stormzy tunes. Speaking of veteran managers, I just want to finish with the news that Liam Buckley will lead Cork City's management team for the rest of the SSE Electricity Men's Premier Division campaign. Lee Siders, of course, appointed Buckley as sporting director in May, initially to support then manager Colin Healy. When Healy walked away from his post less than 24 hours after Buckley's arrival, Buckley will lead the team. Assistant boss Richie Holland and academy coach Liam Kerr will also be there for the rest of the season. Nathan John's going to be chatting cricket a little bit later on, but up next we're going to be chatting to Niall Moran on all things hurling.
Game on.
Hurling.
So Limerick weren't in action last weekend, but all eyes in the hurling world were on Limerick as Tip played Galway and Clare played Dublin in the quarterfinals, bidding for a place to take on Limerick and Kilkenny. And Niall Moran joins us on the line. Niall, we'll start with Tip and Galway. Galway were just too good, but did Tipperary underperform, or did Galway just do what they should have done?
Yeah, I think it's fair enough to say Ruby isn't doing a bit of that in both cases. Tipperary were doing very, very well to be close to where at the end. Do you know what I mean? There was only a point in it coming down the home stretch. And saying that, Galway were really, really good. They had 18 wide, 3 goal chances missed, and so it's probably cast up an 8-point lead, which they had maybe 40 minutes into the game. So definitely, Henry Shefflin will be really, really pleased. You could argue that probably it's been his biggest win with Galway to date, and well deserved. I suppose a team that probably reflected the player himself. And I suppose their qualities, their never say die qualities, their tackling, their attitude, and obviously had a good shot of class thrown into it. And I think for Liam Cannell, even just watching his interview after the game on Saturday, he just looked like a guy who was really pulling his hair out. I suppose it was probably a replica maybe of how Waterford season petered out last year, and I suppose you could have made different arguments with Waterford in the sense that maybe there was issues internally, or maybe there was, you know what I mean, individuals that mightn't have been pulling, but with this Tipperary group they actually gave him everything and were really, really good for most three quarters of the season. But it's just probably the last two outings will leave him with a kind of a bittersweet taste in his mouth. But look, they've made huge progress too, and I think maybe they probably paid the price for having had to do a major body of work early on in the year.
But that progress and this season under Tipperary's belt, could it stand them in good stead for next year?
You'd hope that it would. Again, look, when you're taking over from a different management, you're trying to establish your own patterns, you're trying to establish new S&C programs, you're getting to know players. And like that takes a massive body of work right the way through winter into the early season in the league. And like you have to remember that Tipperary maybe outside of Limerick, and I know Kilkenny got to the final. Like, they were probably the top performers in the National League, started off really, really well in the Championship. But just that game against Waterford, I just think maybe they lost their way a little bit. To lose it, they kind of came against the grain. So just they'll be delighted if they found a couple of really, really good hurlers like Jake Morris. Whilst it wasn't his best performance on Saturday night, he still came of age. They found Alan Tyne, Conor Stakelam, Brian O'Mara, Reece Shelley. So they've a lot of guys found, but I suppose at the other end of the scale, like, you see Seamus Callanan coming off at half time, just one Tipperary's greatest ever hurlers. You see Noel McGrath, probably his worst performance for Noel in the last 2 years. A lot of uncharacteristic wides in the first half. And I suppose you probably have to say, look, for Tipperary to push on, they might need to find three or four more, because look, there's only so much that these lads can do. They've been pillars of Tipperary, they've been legends, and they won nothing to Tipperary hurling. But I suppose if you were to go on and challenge, then there comes a time where you need to probably clear it out a little bit in the sense of that. And so they will have to find new players, and that will be Liam's challenge.
Just the final one on Tip, because I do want to give Galway credit for the win, obviously. But, like, I mean, this is the second year now that a team under Liam Cahill has kind of dipped in form after a really impressive start. Does he need to change how he approaches his plan to this panel in order for Tip to kind of stand the test of time throughout the Championship?
So, look, again, you're only reading in between the lines, and you look at his interview there at the end of it, like, and he's a person who wears his heart in his sleeve. I think any of the players I've ever played under him, each and every one of them have played for him, and that's right the way through from underage. But just watching him there on Saturday, he just looked like a guy who was struggling maybe to come up with a couple of answers himself. But I think, look, I think they're really, really on the right track. He is the right man for the job. And I just think the Tipperary Club Championship, some of the divisional finals were even on yesterday. I think he will just be scouring Tipperary to try and find a couple of more players. And look, Tipperary won the under-17 All-Ireland last year. Those guys will be 19 coming around next year. I think you could see him going with three or four more of these lads, giving them a good pre-season. And look, it might be year three by the time Tipperary start achieving, but I think with a guy like Liam, over them, I definitely think they're on the right track. And look, there's lessons to be learned. Look, they probably did run out of steam. They were flat, but sometimes that's not always down to training. Sometimes that's just guys don't turn up. And look, you can't underestimate losing that game to Waterford would have probably knocked their confidence a little bit. So for a new team, confidence is the only currency that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt Liam Cahill will be chomping at the bit to get going again with Tip. For Galway, though, what impressed you most? And like, will a performance of the same level be enough against Limerick, or how much are they going to have to lift it now for a semi-final?
I think for Galwegians, for the last 2 days, I think they're just going to savour that they had a massive performance. Look, the question that everyone was asking going into is which Galway would have shown up. I personally, I didn't see Galway winning the game. I thought they'd come close to it, but I didn't see them winning the game. I thought that they would have been hit by the sucker punch that they received against Kilkenny. And I think for these couple of days, I think they're entitled to celebrate, and I'm sure there was more than one Jack Grealish out in the town on Saturday night. Galway were really, really good, and they probably have a free shot against Limerick. I think the pressure is on Limerick. People will be saying that Limerick obviously trying to achieve a massive feat and go for four All-Irelands in a row. Like, nobody would have put Galway in the context of being All-Ireland champions, that's 3 or 4 days ago. So I think they have a free shot at it, and you have to remember that Galway have an awful lot of experience there, like the GMAC and Mannions, Dahi Burke, these guys, Joseph Cooney, a lot of guys have won All-Ireland medals who are going to Croke Park a little buoyed by a little bit of confidence. And bear in mind that they were very, very close to beating Limerick last year, and traditionally Limerick would have always found Galway very tricky to shake off. So I think they won't be too worried about Limerick, in the sense that they know they have a free shot at them and well capable of beating them. And obviously, look, we touched on it there last week, the last of Declan Hannan and how we replace him. So the key favourites up to Saturday night to replace Declan would have been Dan Morrissey. But when you see the form that Conor Clooney was in, he will take watching, and that raises questions for Limerick as to who will replace Declan, because they may need Dan in the full back line. So look, just to touch on even Conor Clooney, there was a lot of Clare people in front of me there up around Killinane, and they spoke about his grandfather Jack Woods, and says that he was obviously the bulb off him and how he hurls. And Conor is actually another distant relation of Shane O'Donnell, and those two guys just lit up the Gaelic grounds with their skill on Saturday. And look, it was just majestic to watch him in full flow. He could have had 4-4, ended up at 1-4, and it was definitely the reason why the Galway came out on top.
Yeah, and just final one on Gaal before we do move on to Clare. Like, was it the perfect response mentally as well, considering the heartbreak at the Leinster final? You mentioned that experience, I suppose, in the Galway panel.
Yeah, you'd have to argue, Shane. Like, you know what I mean? Then it's so when you're like those kind of defeats that kind of linger in the system a lot of the times, and suppose you could argue that maybe their Tipperary's defeat against Waterford undid a lot of the good work that they had done, and the same may have been said of Galway had they lost on Saturday. So, look, I think they've banished it. The mental toughness is obviously instilled in them through their management. And I said they're going with a head of steam and going to Croke Park, and they'll take a bit of beating still.
Well, Clare didn't have much trouble overcoming Dublin, and Tony Kelly was on form. Hat trick. Was it Ronaldo or Tony Kelly that was in Limerick at the weekend?
Yeah, it was. Look, Ruby, I suppose you had an exciting week over in Ascot. I suppose Clare in Dublin, if it was a two horse race, one of the horses could have been pulled after 5 or 10 minutes. But all credit to Dublin. Do you know what I mean? They went 1-2 to no score down, lost Donald Burke. And like the game had, after 6 or 7 minutes, when returning somebody, this game has an air of already been over. But to all credit to Dublin, like they went and they stuck at it. But Clare probably played them back into it. They had 9 first half wides. But Dublin just kept at it, and they were very, very strong in the air, very, very pacey when they ran at Clare. And even looking at someone like Paul Crummy, who was corner forward, he was really, really good. Danny Sutcliffe got on a lot of ball, 4 uncharacteristic wides. So, look, the goals, though, it was probably those 2-3 those goals before halftime, it just finished it as a contest. Like, and you're running 9 or 10 points down, 4-8 to 1-8 at halftime. The game was kind of over, and like, the second half just played out a damn squibble. It played out like a challenge game. So, look, there's double elements. I think for Dublin, they've been down so many players right away throughout the year. That Micheál Donoghue, to be fairness, and he's been trying to shuffle the cards every day going out, hoping to try and get a little bit more. And so that's also, given that they probably haven't had as much underage in recent years, it's very, very hard for them to make the progress that they would have made maybe in 2011, 2013. But again, Ruby, Clare have shown their intent. They're not gone anywhere. And I really think that Clare Kilkenny game is just going to be a classic. If Clare can just get over the couple of injuries that they've had, I really, really think it's going to be a classic of a game. And again, they'll be hoping to undo the wrongs that they would have felt that last year in Croke Park when they didn't perform. And with a forward line that was on form, you said about Tony, 3-4, Mark Rogers, 1-11. And David Fitzgerald was just... he was phenomenal. He was like a racehorse going up and down in the middle. Do you know what I mean? They're going to come again with a lot of confidence. And again, they put the Munster final behind them very, very swiftly.
They most certainly did. That's the other side of it. They're both now into semi-finals, Galway and Clare, on the 8th and 9th of July against Limerick and Kilkenny. But the two teams that played in the preliminary quarter-final went out. And these two teams that had to play a quarter-final, will that game stand to them or go against them? Or where would your feelings be on that?
I suppose it reaffirms that out of the provincial championships, we're getting the best teams. Do you know what I mean? Again, the same thing happened again last year. So I suppose that's the consistency of having a league method running, and we can probably see elements of that in the football championship where we seem to be getting all the best teams. They're all still getting through. So, as I said, the extra game yesterday, it's ideal in the sense of getting the final losses out of the system. But the one thing I would be afraid of, just from Clare's perspective, okay, is that Clare still had an awful lot of wides and still looked very, very open at the back. And you would have to question, even though they were won by an awful lot, did they learn the lessons? And in the same way, you could still pose the doubt for Galway in that they were so, so superior. And Tips still nearly beat them coming down the home stretch, which would have been a replica of how they lost the Leinster final. So while you take all the positives out of it, I would think as an opposition going to take them on, you would argue that they still didn't right the wrongs of their previous final outings. And unless both of those teams can do it, then we could see a repeat of last year's All-Ireland.
Well, Ricky Kilkenny for Niall Moran, just by the sounds of that.
I said it from the start, Ruby, and so we'll wait and see.
We want Galway Kilkenny. I want Galway Kilkenny purely for the uproar of Twitter and Munster hurling fans. That Munster hurling is the greatest thing in the world, and to have two Leinster teams in All Ireland final, I'm telling you.
Why would you want that, Shane?
Two teams that play in Leinster.
Well, look, to be fair to you lads, it'd be great to see Croke Park filled on the Ireland final there. So I think we got it, Kenny. We might make the argument to bring the final back to Tullamore or Forty. I think that was the argument for the Leinster final, that you go back to Tullamore. So Tullamore might get a stay in the sun yet.
Well, on that note, Niall Moran, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Game on.
Hurley.
RTE.
2FM.
Game on.
Cricket.
Yeah, you're very welcome back to Game On with myself, Shane Dawson, and Ruby Welsh. Nathan Johns from the Irish Times is still with us. Before we chat cricket, just an update from the European Games. And it is good news because featherweight Michaela Walsh is one win away from booking her ticket to Paris 2024 following a 5-0 last 16 victory over her Turkish opponent in the last while there. So very well done to Michaela Walsh. Aoife O'Rourke, of course, is in the ring in about 20 minutes time. Nathan Johns is here to chat cricket, and I suppose you could start it off, Nathan, by saying good news. Ireland hammered the UAE by 138 runs. Ireland finishing 349 for 4 after 50 overs, with Paul Sterling top scoring on 162 before bowling their opponents out for 211 inside 39 overs. Brilliant news as a standalone result. However, it's 3 defeats from 4 in a disastrous World Cup qualifying campaign. We're not going to the World Cup. Just to put this into context, how damaging is this for Irish cricket?
Well, the easiest way to quantify it is financially. They miss out on the £1 million you get from participating in the World Cup. And the Cricket Ireland CEO, Aaron Dutram, was doing an interview recently where he also said there's a lot more money that is on the line in terms of it's a 40-day competition, and that's if you don't qualify for the knockout. So you're, you know, on those airwaves for 40 days plus the month beforehand of all the build-up or whatever it is, and their sponsorship and a lot of money that is missed out. Financially, it's massive, and you know, it's 12 years now. Provided Ireland do reach the 2027 World Cup, which they should, because that is back up to a 14-team competition, whereas this one is only 10 teams. That it will be 12 years since Ireland last played in a World Cup, and all the famous wins that everyone talks about with Irish cricket, you know, Pakistan in Jamaica 2007, England and India 2011, beat the West Indies in New Zealand 2015. Those are the games that get you and me talking on radio stations.
You get the books out, Raiders of the Caribbean and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You know, so that's what put Irish cricket on the map, both at home and abroad, and that there's going to be now a 12 year gap between opportunities to do that.
But that's in the past, and the players we have playing now are that those victories would have inspired could all possibly be gone. So has this generation inspired the next one that makes you think we'll have a team in 2027?
They'll certainly have a team in 2027. The quality of the team is impossible to say, but it's a really good point. Someone like Harry Tector, he's the seventh best one-day international batter in the world, according to the ICC rankings. Yeah, you can dispute that if you want, but the rankings are there, and he's now not going to play in a World Cup, a 50-over World Cup, until he's 26. You know, he's still a young man at that point, but you know, for one of the top 10 players in the world to not be playing at the World Cup, like you said, not have the opportunity to inspire the next kid, because he was inspired by 2011. That's... Again, it's harder to quantify, but it's important. A lot of these people do grow up wanting to be the Kevin O'Briens of the world, and you know, it's going to be a while until probably somebody who maybe might not have watched cricket otherwise is going to want to be the next Harry Tector.
And how damaging is it to the status of Irish cricket? We are a Test nation. We've losing to association nations in the Netherlands, Oman, Scotland. Is there ramifications for that, or do you just hold your status?
You hold your status, but there certainly are ramifications in terms of your status, like especially because it's 50-over cricket. In T20 cricket, because I chatted to a player about 18 months ago when Ireland were really struggling in T20, the short form format cricket, and he kind of said he thought the public's demand that they beat these teams, the Omans, the Scotlands of the world, in T20 was misguided, because in T20 the games are shorter, so the better sides have less time to show their superior skills, so to speak, so upsets are more common. So Ireland did, I think what he said to me was, you know, we don't have a right to beat these teams, whereas in 50 over cricket, much longer, and Ireland has also played a lot of really good 50 over cricket in the last 2-3 years, it's been their best format by far. So to now lose to teams like Oman and Scotland. Scotland have played 4 games of one-day international cricket this calendar year. They don't play that much. Oman don't play that much. To lose to these teams, it's not going to have any ramifications in terms of the membership. But in terms of what it does for how you're seen by the world, how these, you know, these teams don't fear Ireland, they probably didn't anyway, but they definitely don't now. That's, you know, over time that has a benefit, has an impact.
So if this was soccer or rugby, you'd be looking at who are we pointing the finger at? Well, I wouldn't, but lots of people would be looking at who do you point the finger at? Who is to blame? Who carries the can here?
It's a very interesting question. As always, the product on the pitch is the number one thing. There's a lot of off-field issues in Irish cricket, but even still, Ireland, the reason why this campaign was so disastrous was because they didn't even get through to the next round. There was the group stages and then something called the Super Sixes, and then the top two from that reached the tournaments in India next year. To not even get out of their group, my own thoughts were that Ireland would struggle because, you know, they were playing against Zimbabwe on home soil in the next round, and they've got 10,000 baying fans in Harare. Like, that is one of the occasions of cricket right now, so that would have been a struggle. But to not even get out of the pool is a disaster, and I think for that you blame the players. I mean, they didn't score anywhere near enough runs, they didn't win a toss in the first couple of games, which didn't help. Batting first in both of those two games they lost in those conditions at 9 a.m. on pitches that do a lot for the bowlers is tricky, so you can blame that if you want. The batters didn't score. The top three were in pretty poor form up until today, when Sterling and Balbirnie both finally found some runs. But
sorry, we can nearly rule out today. It was a dead rubber, and yeah, for both teams as well.
So you do blame the players to an extent. They are better than Scotland in Oman. Like, they should not. Whatever about the Sri Lanka game, that was one everyone expected to lose. Losing to Scotland in Oman, when this has been the be all and end all of your World Cup cycle, this tournament is not good enough. You know, flat. I would blame the players 40%. 60% of the blame goes to senior management, because, you know, Scotland only played 4 games this year. Ireland played 9 50 over games since January. Now, that's not an insignificant amount, but they were playing at Lords in a test match that meant absolutely nothing 2 weeks ago. And then in a press conference last week, the head coach says that the conditions in Zimbabwe were completely different from anything they expected, which begs the question, well, what are you doing playing at Lords 2 weeks before the tournament in completely different conditions, in a different hemisphere, in a different season? It's winter in Zimbabwe. Why are you not going down there 2 weeks early and finding a team to play against in these warm-up games and things like that? And the reasons for that are financial. Lords brings in money and sponsorship, etc. So there's a serious question to be asked of, was this side as best prepared as it possibly could be for this tournament? And I don't think that was the sole reason why they didn't qualify. Like I said, the players let themselves down when it mattered, but you can certainly ask that question.
Well, it will be interesting to see where do we go next, because I think Jarrod Siggins had a good piece in the Sunday Independent of, he noted that last time there was a major failure, Cricket Ireland hired ex-Ireland and South Africa coach Adrian Birrell to write a scathing report, which was then ignored. Are we going to get another report and it goes nowhere, or is there going to be actual change here to see where can Ireland go next?
And a group of expensive London consultants alongside Eddie Birrell, which is
heading past for the course. They always get
that's standard.
I think they got more money than Mr. Birrell did, that's for sure. They could easily do another review. I mean, they won't do it instantly, because at the end of July they got to go to Scotland for T20 World Cup qualifiers. Now, that would be complete Armageddon if they don't come out of those, because it's only really themselves and Scotland of note in that competition. Some people are talking about Italy might spring a surprise based on the players that they're nicking from Australia. Like, they're getting some granny rule people. They're doing it, you know, the Jack Charlton recruitment tactics of getting some lads in. Now, that would be complete...
If Italy beat Ireland in cricket, like, and then you have a 3 T20 internationals against India in Malahide,
look, the team is in a very... You worry about the headspace the team is in at the minute. They should qualify for the T20 World Cup. But in terms of what next, I can't believe they're going to do another review. I mean, can they afford to do another review? Cricket Ireland would say that they are implementing some of the things that the recommendations that were made. I mean, the quality of domestic training facilities. They've made an attempt to improve the ill-fated high-performance centre that was promised years ago, finally opened in the spring. So, you know, there are small steps being made. I think the main issue with that review was that 90% of what was in it was already being said by coach and captain, so to speak. I think was kind of the general sense, is like, why are you paying these people to do this when we've been telling you this for years? So I don't necessarily think the review is being ignored, but I can't see that happening again, purely because the attention, that the negative reaction that review got, I don't think they'd open themselves up for that again.
Okay. Well, never before has a Test nation lost 3 consecutive games against associates. Ireland have done, and going down to Netherlands, Oman and Scotland. Of their last 7 ODIs against sides outside the Test world, Ireland have won only 2. But fear not, there is a high performance centre in Abbottstown that perhaps only touring teams will want to play there. But sure, it will be interesting to see where Cricket Ireland goes from here. Nathan Johns, thank you very much for coming into studio. Ruby, I believe that is all we have time for.
It is indeed, Shane. Thank you for your company this evening. Thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced, and Laura Lee was our BCO. I do believe Beto De Silva is up next. I hope you enjoyed the hour.
He is indeed. Shlán. RTE 2FM.